9:15 p.m. West Pakistan time, 10:15 p.m. East Pakistan time. This is Radio Pakistan. In a few moments from now, the President, Mr. Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, will address the nation on the new labor policy. The President's address will be followed by its translation in Urdu. Ladies and gentlemen, the President.
I am happy to announce today, within 7 weeks of assuming office, a new labor policy which will guarantee to workers their fundamental rights consistent with the requirements of industrial development of the state. I want to emphasize that this is only a first step towards the fulfillment of our pledge to the workers. We are not so naive as to think that a mere new set of laws will transform overnight national economic life. We have tried to introduce certain basic reforms, reforms, I may add, which were long overdue, but which no previous government dared to introduce. The iniquitous economic system that has prevailed for so long cannot be changed in a day, but we are making a determined beginning in the highest interests of the workers. I will outline briefly some of the main features of the legislation we are introducing. The Labour Minister will elucidate the salient features of this policy tomorrow in a press conference. Workers will be given effective participation in the management of industry. This will be progressively increased. As soon as the legislation and connected formalities are completed, workers' representatives will be associated with management to the extent of 20% at factory level. This will be done soon. At a prescribed level of industrial unit and under certain spelt out stipulation, they will also have the authority to appoint an auditor with powers to inspect any accounts, records, premises or stores of a factory. This auditor will be paid by the management of the concerned prescribed unit. Further, we have decided to raise to 4% from 2.5% the share of the workers in the annual profits under the existing Companies Profits Workers Participation Act 1968. If the workers increase productivity, they may receive an additional 10% of the increased profits. In order to make the trade union movement truly effective, we have decided to introduce a system of shop stewards at the lowest production level of prescribed industrial units. Each shop or department in such a factory will have a shop steward who will be elected by secret ballot by the workers of the shop from among themselves. He will represent their interest and point of view in the management of that shop, and will act as a link between the workers and management of prescribed units. To ensure that workers' grievances receive full and efficacious justice, we have decided to introduce a new streamlined procedure which provides for a worker, himself or through his shop steward, to bring his grievances to the notice of management. And if no redress is given within a period prescribed, the matter may be taken to the labor union or the labor court. In such cases, the labor court will give its decision within 20 days and not 60 days as is done at present. The law relating to settlement of collective disputes has also been reformed to provide expeditious settlement. Works councils will be strengthened and the scope of their function widened to include all matters which can go before labor courts. Formerly, collective disputes had first to be referred only to management, but now workers will have the option to refer for a bilateral settlement collective disputes to the workers' council in which both they and management will be represented. A further revision in the law will provide that instead of waiting for 21 days for serving a strike notice, a notice may be served within 3 days if management does not respond favorably or there is failure of bilateral negotiations in the work councils. Under the new law, a matter may be taken to labor court by either party. Formally, this could be done only if both workers and management agreed jointly. Thus, the workers, while retaining their right to strike, will have the option to get immediate adjudication by court. This provision is designed to save the workers from being forced to go on strike, which they had to do in the past, merely because management did not agree to move the court. The court's award will now be given within 30 days and not 60 days as previously. I would add that the right of clerical staff of banks to collective bargaining is now being restored, and in this connection, lower supervisory levels will be included in the definition of workmen. In order to ensure that strikes do not take place without the consent or against the interest of the general body of workers, it has been made obligatory for unions to hold a secret ballot before resorting to strikes. We intend to give full protection to workers against arbitrary retrenchment and termination of services by making it necessary for every order of retrenchment and termination of service to state reasons explicitly in writing. This will not only reduce substantially injustice to the workers, but will also facilitate scrutiny by courts of the merits of each case. We have decided to make compulsory the payment of bonus to employees either in cash or NIT shares at the option of the workers. The amount of bonus will be linked with profits so that increase in production and the prosperity of workers go hand in hand. We have also decided to extend the application of Payment of Wages Act 1936 and Industrial Employment Standing Orders Ordinance 1968 to labor under contractors. This will ensure regular payments, overtime pay, and proper rates of payments. We naturally attach great importance to housing and will do everything possible to have it provided to the maximum extent possible. The Workers' Welfare Fund for housing and other major facilities was created some time back. This has remained a paper fund only. We have therefore decided that representative committees will be set up, comprising nominees of workers and management, and including representatives of the provincial governments, to go into the financial and other circumstances of each undertaking in the area and decide what further contribution, over and above the minimum one laid down by law, should be made by employers for these facilities. Even more important is education, and we have decided that employers shall provide free education up to matric to one child of every worker. The others will progressively be looked after by the state. This will naturally not apply to industrial units already providing better facilities to the children of workers. We have carefully reviewed the social security scheme and introduced major reforms in it. First, the levy of 2% of a worker's wages for providing him with medical facilities has been abolished, and the existing 4% contribution made by the employer will be raised to 6%. In due course, additional steps will be taken for the provision of further medical facilities to workers. Secondly, provision for old age pension will be made for all workers at a certain age. Compulsory group insurance for workers against death and injury when off duty will be introduced. Thirdly, the Social Security scheme will be appropriately extended to cover domestic servants. The existing laws regarding safety and safety measures and workmen's compensation in the event of death or injury are being revised. Increased rates of compensation will be provided. Group benefit schemes will be introduced as incentive to workers to compete in increasing efficiency and production in each plant. Measures will at the same time be taken to see, as far as possible, equitable distribution of employers' contribution between workers in capital-intensive and labor-intensive undertakings. One major shortcoming has existed all along in labor legislation. Infringement of certain provisions, such as payment of compensation in case of death or injury, payment of overtime wages, provision of canteens on premises and other such facilities, have not been treated as cognizable offences. Violation of all such provisions are being made cognizable, though bailable. We have also decided upon a large number of measures to promote the growth of workers' movement along progressive lines. I will mention only the more important of these measures. To strengthen the growth of the trade union movement, we have decided to set up a quasi-judicial authority with three main aims. Firstly, to promote genuine trade unionism at the trade level and ensure representative character of unions. Secondly, to help in the setting up of federations of unions industry-wise. Thirdly, to help in the formation of federations at the national level. It will also deal with cases of victimization of office bearers of trade unions and unfair labor practices on the part of employers as well as trade unions. We have given serious consideration to the question of the minimum wage. We do not think it advisable to take hurried measures. Only 2 years ago, the minimum wage was increased, but a corresponding benefit has not accrued to the wage earner, nor has it increased his purchasing power. It only resulted in a serious price spiral, which is not yet checked. Before increasing minimum wages, it is essential to stabilize the prices so that the benefit of the increased wage becomes substantial in its practical sense, instead of getting eaten away by galloping inflation. After careful consideration, it has been decided that at this initial stage, when we are about to begin the task of salvaging the national economy, an increase in money wages will further aggravate the inflationary situation. We have instead, at this moment, introduced measures relating to participation in profit, housing, education, and the abolition of 2% levy under the Social Security scheme, which are designed to increase the workers' real income. At the same time, we are making every effort to stabilize the prices of essential items of daily use, such as atta, sugar, vegetable, ghee, kerosene oil, and cloth. We believe that these measures we are taking will result in true and meaningful benefits to the workers. It is our intention to peg wages to prices, as is the practice in the Scandinavian and some other advanced countries. This will be done when the economic situation normalizes and when production increases. To bear this and other reforms, including increase in minimum wages, there must be a rapid increase in production. We are facing a crisis in production. This crisis must be surmounted to increase national wealth and national welfare of the laboring classes and of our society as a whole. I would like to emphasize that our economic salvation lies in making a determined effort to increase production. Since the 20th of December, martial law notwithstanding, gheraus and jalaus seem to have become the order of the day. This unruly and rowdy practice, negative in its purpose, anarchistic in its approach, nihilist in its results, has been endured, regrettably, by the government and the people for over 7 weeks. The object of this exercise in patience was to show the people, and indeed even the participants, that this simply is not the proper form of protest or of ventilation of grievances. It is a self-destructive procedure. The majority of the people have shown their disgust over these demonstrations of hooliganism. They want an end to it. They want a return to sensible and civilized methods of protest. Even the participants, excepting the ringleaders, are getting disillusioned with this practice. National leaders have spoken against it. Public opinion is clear on the matter. Taking all these factors into account, now I want to make it clear that the strength of the street will be met by the strength of the state. For long, the people have tolerated this intolerable form of threat and thunder. It must stop. I say, as a friend and associate of those who have been innocently misled to indulge in one gherao after another, it is in their interest and in the interest of the rest of the people to put an end to this form of lawlessness. Scores have been settled, pent-up energies have been released, so let everyone return to the path of normality. Let nobody take these remarks light-heartedly either. In future, the full weight of law will be visited on such forms of illegal demonstration. The government is not only aware of the workers' problems, but is fully receptive and sympathetic. We have provided the workers with every legal means for redress of grievances. Let them now try these methods, which are in their true interest. I am speaking to you candidly to prepare you for the strenuous times lying ahead. But I am confident that if all of us try hard and work hard, we will all benefit. Of necessity, it will have to be a collective effort. This is the only way to serve Pakistan, to ensure that the children of our toiling masses, who have seen nothing but misery and hardship for centuries, will live in a better Pakistan, a more secure and happy Pakistan. Our sacrifices will not go in vain. We are making basic adjustments, not without a purpose. All our yesterdays have seen failure. Let us strive for a better tomorrow, a morrow at the service of the common man.
Foreign Minister had this to say: should Pakistan be subjected to foreign aggression, the Chinese government and people will, as always, resolutely support the Pakistan government in their just struggle to defend their state sovereignty and national independence. Would you agree that Chinese support in the recent conflict with India fell some way short of that?
That's behind us now, but I would say that within the limitations, China did what she could. Some people think China could have done more, but I think that you have to take a number of factors into account in assessing China's role in the last conflict. And a series of successive blunders were committed by the Yahya regime. Events moved so fast that other countries did not have time to fully assess them. So you have to take all these factors into account. And as I said, that's now a past event. We have to look to the future. But whatever has been China's participation, we have not lost confidence in China's friendship or in China's word.
When the idea of separation was first seriously mooted at the end of 1970, after Mujib's election victory, you said you were too passionately committed to the concept of Pakistan to think of such an idea. Well, the idea has now, of course, been rather forcibly brought to your attention, and has indeed become a political reality. Do you intend to spend any time trying to undo it?
Well, I still maintain that Pakistan and its concept are not really passing phenomena. and that the present reality might not be a permanent reality. And so far, we are trying to make a search, a genuine search to maintain some form of modus vivendi between the two wings. Sooner or later, the sentiments for Pakistan will grow again, but that's for another day. At the moment, we still are making a search. For this reason, in the field of external affairs, we have had to painfully and regrettably leave the Commonwealth on this account and also break relations with certain countries. But even if there is parting of the ways, I think it will not be a permanent parting of the ways. The two of us will come together again in some form or shape. I cannot say what that form or shape will be, but you will see yourself that sentiment for Pakistan will again grow in that battle of the country.
Given that something like one in three of the entire United Nations membership has now recognized Bangladesh, isn't there something to be said for the view that until you do too, you aren't going to be able to give your full attention to the daunting tasks of reconstruction facing you here?
I think you might have noted that I've shown my anxiety and my willingness to hold negotiations with Sheikh Mujibur Rahman on the one hand and with the government of India on another. And until we hold these discussions, I don't think it would be fair to us to ask us for our final position.
During the final months of your predecessor's rule, one of your most insistent demands was for the restoration of democratic processes. What will the main features in such a restoration be? And what sort of timescale do you envisage?
When I made this demand, the war had not taken place. And half of our country had not come under the occupation of India. So now also, I believe in my demand, and I will see to it that people of Pakistan return to democracy soon. And I'd like to see that they return to democracy for all times, so that we establish institutions with roots, and that no military or civilian adventurer will ever dare to inject one martial law after another into our country again. I want to build institutions, strengthen existing institutions. And when I say existing institutions, I think the only one really that remains is the judiciary, unfortunately. So this is the institution we can strengthen. The remaining ones we'll have to build again. We want a constitution, and we want to have the rule of law restored in the country. We want to have freedom of press, freedom of association, fundamental rights, and a viable constitution suited to our conditions.
You've been asked many times since you became president how long you intend to retain martial law. You said very shortly after you became president, not a day longer, not a minute longer, not a second longer than necessary. How much longer do you think, in fact, you are going to need it?
I stand by that commitment, and I believe in it. I want to withdraw martial law. I'm not happy with martial law. I would like to see it gone by yesterday. But the point is that not only have certain basic reforms to be implemented, but I must have at least one meeting with the Indian leaders and one with Sheikh Mujibur Rahman to get a general idea of the situation, to get some idea of the general picture. Now, I know that by dialogue alone, what they say, I won't get an exact idea. But a politician makes an assessment not only on the words spoken, but on the general feel. And I want to have that general feel, and I think the world should be fair to me to get that general feel before I can give a timetable. Because I think very few countries have gone through a crisis that my country has gone through. I don't think even Poland, which was dismembered rather badly, went through a crisis as deep as Pakistan is going through. So I'm not trying to procrastinate. I know the dangers of procrastination. I'm not so foolish as to try and hang on to power by the threat of martial law. I'd like to be in a position of respectable responsibility. And that can only come with a constitution. And I've earned that right in an election. So I am anxious and eager to withdraw it. But I must have, to be fair to my people, to be fair to what remains of my country at the moment, to have some idea of the general situation before I can announce a date.
You've always taken a very hard line against India. In 1965, when relations were particularly bad over Kashmir, you called her a feeble, flippant, decadent society. Yes. And when you were out electioneering, before the last elections here, You promised in the main two things. A redistribution of wealth and a thousand-year war against India. How important is it to you to be able to work out some sort of modus vivendi with India?
That's important. Even when my posture was different, when I was preaching confrontation, there was a theme in that confrontation. That was, confrontation would be inevitable until the fundamental disputes are settled. Now, after this war, the fundamental disputes have still to be settled, if not by confrontation, by consultation, and by negotiations. An imposed peace will simply not work. So really, only the situation has changed, but it has changed radically. In those days, we had certain opportunities, and our governments missed them. Now, India thought she had an opportunity, and she didn't miss it. For instance, in 1962, during the Sino-Indian conflict, when India had vacated most of her forces from Kashmir, our armies could have walked.